From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, a roundtable discussion that is bound to affect all of you. I haven't done one of these in a long time, so get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Fast food worker strikes are expanding to more U.S. cities and going global now. Workers in up to 150 cities across the country are planning to strike on May 15th. The movement is also headed overseas with plans for workers to join protests now in 33 countries. The workers announced the protests outside of McDonald's in New York City and delivered a letter that called on the fast food giant to raise wages and respect workers' rights worldwide. Security guards did not allow the workers to bring the letter inside. They posted it on the door, then it was removed. Workers from fast food giants like McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Yum Brands, owner of KFC, have been walking off their jobs, calling on employers to pay them a minimum wage of $15 an hour and allow them to form unions without retaliation. We'll see how that unfolds. A slumping housing market and geopolitical tensions risk undermining the U.S. economy and bear close watching by the Federal Reserve. In testimony to Congress, Fed Chairperson Janet Yellen repeated her stance that the economy was still in need of lots of support given the considerable slack in the labor market. Advisor Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Well, Catherine, that sounds like pretty strong words coming from Yellen.
Yes, it is. And Yellen has the best record of any governor. Of course, she's now chairman of any governor predicting sort of the economic trends. So this comes from somebody who's a very detailed person, watches the economy, knows what she's talking about.
We're going to have to see what happens. You're going to be with us next hour as part of the roundtable discussion.
Oh, George, we are going to have a great time.
I am looking forward to that. Thanks, Catherine. Appreciate that. Well, the group Boko Haram, which means Western education is a sin, launched an attack on a Nigerian village in an area that troops have been using as a base in the search for hundreds of schoolgirls abducted by the militant group. It's truly one of the sickest stories I've heard in a long time. The hours-long assault left at least 150 people dead, some of whom were burned alive. It is the latest in a series of brazen attacks and abductions by Boko Haram, raising concern about whether the Nigerian government can even retake control of the region from this terror group. Robert Young Pelton, explorer, journalist, with us. Robert, you've seen a lot of stories come down as well. This one's got to be one of the strangest and worst I've ever heard.
Yeah, well, you have to understand that this has been going on for a while, since about 2003, and there's a natural split between the Muslim North and the Christian South in Nigeria. But, you know, the West is particularly attuned to stories that involve young women, you know, in school, abducted by al-Qaeda franchises. But keep in mind that al-Qaeda is looking for these type of opportunities to draw us into conflicts all around the world, because that's ultimately their goal, is to bring us there.
Robert, this group, kidnapping girls, selling them for as little as $12 a piece, what do they want? They're not doing this for money, are they?
Well, okay, so Boko Haram is an affiliate of al-Qaeda, and they have been resisting the sort of the Southern Christian government. But what really happened is that the military kidnapped a number of their wives and families after a 2009 crackdown. And so they've taken a specific interest in going after women and sort of kidnapping, you know, spectacular numbers of children. They've also killed up to about 60-some-odd school children, because their main focus is on, you know, destroying the idea that these youth should be educated in a Western way.
Jeez. And you went off to look for Joseph Kony. Any luck when you were out there?
Well, I was with Riek Machar, the last person to be with Joseph Kony, who also was hiding in the bush. And so I was out there. I was very successful. I was with the White Army and all the fighting. and I'm going back out the car. Joseph Kony's in Kafia Kingi now, which is a part of South Sudan. But if you go to Vice.com on Monday, you'll see the documentary, and you can read the 50,000-word magazine article that I wrote on the entire event.
So you got very close to him.
Well, my goal was to really make sure that all my assumptions were correct and that the idea of Joseph Kony hiding in the bush is not really true. So I was able to find his people in Nairobi and also set up a very, I think, a very secure meeting in the next month or so.
Okay, thank you so much. Robert Young Pelton. Hundreds of thousands of pieces of man-made debris are floating around out there in space. Due to more than 50 years of space flight, there have been chunks of dead satellites, spent rocket boosters, even a glove that an astronaut dropped in 1965, a spatula that escaped from a space shuttle in 2006. And because it all zips along faster than a speeding bullet, the trash poses an ever-growing threat to the satellites that help the military communicate, gather intelligence, and, of course, our obsession with Google Earth and on-demand movies and everything else. What will the Pentagon do about all of that, though? Potential collisions with space junk. It's a major story. Well, a man from Florida believes he should be allowed to get married to his MacBook computer. His name is Chris Sevier. He states that he's fallen in love with his computer, and he says, I even applied for a marriage license, but was denied for some reason. One of the greatest American musicians, singer-songwriters, Bob Dylan, also named Robert Zimmerman. In a moment, I get to talk with Robert Zimmerman on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. As I was mentioning, Bob Dylan, American musician, singer-songwriter, he is one of the best. Born Robert Zimmerman, and my producers have lined up a exclusive interview with me with Robert Zimmerman. And Bob, I've got to tell you, this is exciting to have you on the show.
George, you've got the space historian, Bob Zimmerman, not the has-been songwriter, Bob Dylan.
Excuse me?
That's right. This is Bob Zimmerman, space historian, the guy who tells you when ISS is going to come crashing down to Earth.
You're not...
Yeah, I can't sing a note.
Oh, my gosh. How did this happen? I'm kidding. I've been wanting to do this with you ever since you've been on the air.
It's an old joke. But it makes you happy. That's okay.
That's right. Little things humor me, Bob. Hey, you just heard that story about space debris.
Yeah.
How bad is that?
It's a problem that has to be dealt with at some point. In fact, there's money to be made. I'm always looking for the money-making aspect of this, and there are several companies that are actually right now trying to put together for profit junk clearance. We pay our governments to clear out the sides of roads of dead animals, and that's what they do, and they do it, and it's necessary to be done. Well, at some point, this is going to have to be taken care of in space. It's an increasing problem, it has to be taken care of. There's no way around it. As we increasingly lower the cost to orbit, there's going to be more and more things put up into orbit, and they have to be able to feel safe that they're not going to be hit by junk created. Like the Chinese a few years ago decided to do an anti-satellite test, and they picked one of their old satellites to blow up. That just happened to be in the worst possible orbit for doing this. And they were told by their own engineers and by I don't know how many other people, because it leaked out they were going to do this, don't do this. And they did it, and they've been endlessly embarrassed by it because they caused problems. I mean, ISS dodges the Chinese debris periodically, and it's got to be taken care of.
How can they track this debris, Robert, when they in most cases, can't even find large chunks of asteroids until they're right up on us?
Well, we're talking about two different things. I mean, the stuff that's in orbit, we know it's in orbit. And we have especially the U.S. military, has very sophisticated radar equipment, tracking equipment. They can track things like inch across, small stuff.
Wow.
They know what's up there to the smallest piece. And because it's in orbit, it's a known quantity. the asteroids that come in, the meteorites, some of them are coming from directions you don't know they're there. You just don't know they're there. If something's on a collision course with Earth, and it's never been here before, and it's out there in the dark, and you know, asteroids are dark to begin with. I was with some amateurs just earlier this week doing a meteorite hunt. They had tracked the meteorite, and they were trying to see if they could find it, and they brought some samples with them to say, so you'd know what to look for in this desert climate. You know, there's rocks everywhere. How'd you know the difference? Well, they brought some sample meteorites, and they're like charcoal briquettes. So you got a charcoal briquette flying out in space against the black sky. It's not going to be easy to see. And so that's why that's a different problem. It's a more difficult problem, and it's, in many ways, a more dangerous problem than space travel.
Sure. When these private companies launch, are they all tuned in and aware of the space debris and when to launch, when not to, so they don't hit it?
It's not that serious a problem yet. I mean, you can launch and pretty confident that anything you put into orbit is going to be pretty clear of debris. The problem is down the road, big objects, especially like ISS, they have to keep track of what's there and be aware of it so that they can dodge it. As a general rule, though, things you put in orbit at this stage are not, they don't have to, like, maneuver around objects. It's not that crowded. Space is a big place. You got other problems, like in geosynchronous orbit, you've got a lot of satellites up there, many of which are in parking orbits because they no longer function. There's still tons and tons of room up, but at some point, we're going to have to start salvage operations in space to start clearing this stuff out.
So the situation in Ukraine, still tense, though it appears that Russia may be backing down somewhat, but that's not really been confirmed. But the bottom line is that they have been taking up and bringing back astronauts to the International Space Station. What if they simply say, enough is enough, we're not taking you, and we're not bringing you back?
Well, first, George, I'd like to mention that the situation in the Ukraine, even though Putin said today that he was, you know, pulling back his troops, there's no confirmation of that. And I have it from other sources, some interesting information. This situation in the Ukraine, I don't think is going to settle down. The Russians cannot hold the Ukraine without obtaining electrical power and water that is only available to Ukrainian territory that they don't hold yet. So they're going to run out of water and power in the Ukraine, and they got to somehow supply it. And the only way they can supply it is grabbing some of the Ukrainian territory nearby. So this situation is not going to cool down.
No, I don't think so either.
And if it gets hotter, that brings us back to space, because the U.S. the U.S. should respond in some manner, or we would expect us to. But if we respond more harshly, the Russians are going to respond in kind. And the situation at ISS is very delicate. Because, first of all, yes, the Russians are the only ones that can get astronauts up and down from ISS. We will not have the capability to do this with our own spacecraft for at least another 2 to 3 years. Even if we accelerate the program, it's still going to take at least a year to a year and a half, even at top speed, even if we're willing to bypass some of our modern play-it-safe rules. It's still a year and a half away before we can get our own astronauts to ISS at the minimum. And so if they decide, if the tensions really get bad, yes, they take possession of ISS. We have no way to get our astronauts there. But on the other hand, they can't control the station without us. Because of their own problems of quality control in their space industry, their part of the space station is way behind schedule. They haven't launched most of the modules for their half of the station yet. And those modules contain solar panels to provide their part of the station energy. Right now, they're completely dependent on our main truss, which has the giant 4 solar panels on it that produces the power for the whole station. And that's controlled from the Johnson Space Flight Center.
Uh-huh.
So if they cut us off, they're at our mercy to run the station. So it becomes a very delicate situation. If the two sides get really angry at themselves and really get tense, you never know what will happen, but we could be in a situation where the station isn't operable. And at that point, we risk a giant piece of space junk, George, coming down to Earth. And I mean, it's a big one, and it will hit the ground. And if you can't be controlled, it could hit the ground anywhere. And lot of pieces will hit the ground. This will be a lot worse than Mir. It's bigger than Mir by a lot. So it's a delicate situation by many means. And there's more complications. For example, the Russians depend on the commercial launches they get from Western satellites. They get a lot of money because they're very competitive and they want to make money. So their rockets are purchased by everybody to launch satellites. And the sanctions that have been imposed have already put a crimp on this. Iridium is one of those companies that is putting up a new constellation of satellites. And their first launch might be delayed because it's going to be on a Russian rocket.
What happens to the Russians' ability to launch when privatization really takes up? You know, companies are going to do it and bypass Russia.
That could very well be the case. But the Russians have one advantage. Their labor costs are really low. So they can they're competitive with everyone. SpaceX's launch prices with its Falcon 9 is the cheapest in the world right now, but the Russians are very competitive. And from a financial and reliable, as a general rule, their launches are good. So they are, you know, if you want a reasonably priced launch, the Russians are a perfectly good customer to go to. They will have problems competing with many different American companies because of the innovation and therefore the ability of the American companies to lower the cost, and at some point lower the cost to a point where they can't compete. They have just centralized their whole aerospace industry. Instead of having many competing companies that they've done for the last 20 years since the fall of the Soviet Union, they just, under Putin, they've now decided to go back to the Soviet way. They have centralized their whole industry into one giant federal agency run by the federal government, and therefore it's now Soviet style. Now, that can be good in some ways because it gets you, you know, you can be very focused and it's ruled from above. They can really dictate terms to the companies, do this, do that. But it squelches innovation from below and creativity. And the end result is what we saw with the Soviet Union, such a collapse. So, yes, I don't think the Russians in the long run are going to be able to compete with us very successfully. In the short run, yes. There are other issues, though. You know, we're still dependent on them. Our Atlas V rocket, which is one of the military's most dependable rockets, one they depend on greatly, uses Russian rocket engines. And the sanctions now, there's an injunction against using those engines, which means the Atlas V rocket can't launch, which means the Air Force has lost one of its most essential rockets. So that's a national security issue. On top of that, the Atlas V was going to be used by Dream Chaser and by Boeing CST-100 capsules. These are the two of the three manned ferrying systems that we're developing right now to replace the Russians. So the Atlas V rocket, which those two of the three depend on, can't launch because it doesn't have an engine for its first stage.
Jeez.
It's a very complicated situation. There's the Orbital Sciences, one of the companies that provides cargo to ISS. Their rocket for the Cygnus capsule uses a Russian engine as well. And they've been actually for the last 2 years, they're aware of this, long before the Ukraine, they were working to replace that engine. And they've just successfully had a merger with another aerospace company, ATK, which built the solid rocket boosters on the shuttle. And they say they're going to use those solid rocket boosters engines instead of the Russian engine. But it's going to take them years to get that into place.
Well, with
a very complicated situation.
Bob Zimmerman with us, his website, behindtheblack.com. I want to talk with you when we come back after the break about Mars, Robert. And NASA unveiled a new Mars spacesuit a week or so ago. What'd you think of that?
I thought it was a great publicity stunt by NASA. I don't take it very seriously at this stage because, you know, I always like to take the problems as they come, George. We can't put humans in space yet. Going to Mars is a later problem.
Yeah, it sure is. Stay with us, Robert Zimmerman, not Bob Dylan, but that was my little spoof. I didn't do much on April 1st this year, so I had to do it this time. His website, again, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And if you go to our website, by the way, just peruse some of the information that all our guests have provided. and take some notes and listen to the show. We shall be back. Well, next hour, our roundtable discussion about the world and your money. So make sure you're part of that program. And welcome back. Bob Zimmerman with us, space historian. One of his books, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8. We'll take your phone calls with him this remaining portion of the hour as well. Robert, do we even really have a space program? I mean, really?
No, George, we really don't. We haven't really had a space program since the 60s. What we've had for the last 40 years has been a government employment program to funnel, instead of ferrying astronauts to and from space, we've been ferrying money into congressional districts. That's essentially what we're doing. And I said this on your show before, and I'll say it again, I don't want a space program because that's so limiting in vision.
Mm-hmm.
I want us to have a chaotic, exuberant, free aerospace industry with many different people and companies following their own visions, making money from it, and in the end getting where they want to go and taking other people with them as they do it. That's what I want. I don't want a program. It would be really good if one set of companies is trying to land on the moon to do tourism, while another set is doing suborbital flights, while another one is making money cleaning up space junk, while another company is setting its eyes on Mars. Another one wants to mine the asteroids. That's what I want to see. Then you don't have a program. You've got it all, and that's where I'm coming from. We don't have that now, but we're in that transition right now, getting out of a Soviet-style, a top-down space program to a more bottom-up, innovative, American-style, chaotic system. And once that happens, the sky's the limit at that point.
Are we being surpassed, or are we still ahead of the game?
Well, it's a yes and a no. At this moment in time, we are not ahead of the game. We can't put astronauts in space. Two other countries in the world can. We can't. So that puts us behind. There's no way around that. We have certain advantages of other countries because we have a very deep social structure, technological society, educated workforce, and a creative culture that encourages innovation. And so that gives us a lot of strength. We just have to unleash those strengths, and we have been squelching them and putting balls and chains on that creativity for decades. And what's beginning to happen now is that's beginning to break free. And once that happens, there ain't anything that's going to stop the United States.
Of the private companies, is there one that's way ahead of the game?
Yeah, the SpaceX is without question way ahead of the game right now. They not only have the cheapest rocket in the game right now with the Falcon 9, they are developing, you know, they just released images. I have this on Behind the Black video of this test flight. They test flew a first stage prototype of their Falcon 9 rocket where it uses its engines to land, just like in science fiction in the 50s. And at the same time, in their last launch of the Falcon 9 with the Dragon capsule, they attempted to bring the first stage down to what they called a soft splashdown. This was just engineering test. They want to see if they can use its rocket engines after it's separated from the second stage to lower it to the Earth safely. And they were able to bring it down over the ocean vertically, still operating. And they had data from it after it hit the water. And the video that they released, though very, very poor quality, shows enough information to say that this rocket was vertical under control. They are very close to innovating, having the first stage reusable. If the first stage becomes reusable, they'll cut the price for launch by 50 to 100%. And that, once
that's
again,
dramatic.
It's spectacular at that point. You start to then make it possible for enormous numbers of people to be able to afford to put payloads into space, and the sky opens up at that point. So they're way ahead, and of course, Dragon is the manned capsule, George, that will be our first manned spacecraft since the shuttle. It already has flown a bunch of times. It was designed to carry people right from the start. It just needs to have some additions to it. They're planning to do their first test of those additions, flight test, this year. So they will probably be ready before anyone else to do that.
It's a California-based company, isn't it?
Yes, I'm sorry, say again.
California-based company, isn't it?
Yes, they're California-based. However, they are buying land in Texas near Brownsville, the southern tip of Texas on the Gulf Coast, because they want to make that a spaceport. That's at least what is indicated at this point. They've gotten, in fact, their environmental clearances. They just need to buy enough land. And so they're going to have their own spaceport in Texas. They already have a 20-year lease, I think it's 20 years, in the Kennedy Space Center for their launch pad there. So even if they're a California-based company, they have their operations in many other places. And they are by far, yes, the team, the company in the lead, and the one that everyone's got to compete with.
Privately held or public?
They're privately held. And, in fact, Elon Musk in a Twitter feed just last week said, don't expect an IPO in the near future. They can keep it under control. He has venture capitalists who are giving him money to keep the company running, plus they are making profit, but they don't see any reason to go public. If they go public, they lose a great deal of the control they have, and I think that that control is one of the reasons they've been able to be so creative. The corporate setup tends to force you to take fewer risks, and this is a risky business. You got to take risks to succeed.
Yet he went public with his Tesla motors.
Yeah, you know, it's a matter of choice. Tesla, I have a feeling he couldn't get the investment capital to make Tesla work, so he had to try to convince the public to buy the stock to create the investment capital for that company. I personally think Tesla is a much greater in financial risk than SpaceX and the aerospace part of his
I think effort. So, too. I think. Let's go to the phones. Drew is in Santa Rosa, California, west of the Rockies. Drew, you're on with Bob Zimmerman.
Hey, Bob. I got a couple questions for you guys. I'll take them off the air, too. My first question is, I heard a story about a black satellite that's floating around the Earth that's supposed to be like 13,000 years old.
It's called the Black
Knight.
I
was wondering if that's up there, and maybe that's where we're getting all our technology advancement from. And then my second question is, have we ever been to the moon? Because we have no pictures of a human standing on the moon taking a picture of the Earth. There's no photographs anywhere online of somebody standing on the moon taking a picture looking at the Earth.
Bob, I'm going to let you take the moon question, and I'll handle the Black Knight satellite.
We landed on the moon. Men died to make it possible for us to land on the moon. The reason that you haven't seen a picture of the Earth from the moon's orbit, from the surface of the moon, is just a matter of photography. Their focus wasn't to take pictures of the Earth on the moon. Their focus was to take pictures of the moon. On the moon, the lighting was such that they wouldn't have gotten a very good picture of the Earth anyway, because it would have overexposed. That's not the same thing as taking it from orbit. And we landed on the moon. People died. It's an incredible thing to me that anyone would think, from even that petty piece of information, that we did land on the moon.
It is strange, Bob, but there are a lot of people who don't think we did. I do. You know, when I'm with Edgar Mitchell, he's on the moon. When I was with Buzz Aldrin on the Larry King show, if you went up to him and, he punched out a guy.
That's right.
Who went after him like that.
Hey, look, you and I lived during the Luna mission. There were a million people at Cape Canaveral to watch the Saturn V take off. A million people watched it. Probably that many people and 100,000 companies were involved in building parts for it. The whole country was involved in this in some manner. 6 degrees of separation, you probably only had to go like 2 degrees of separation to find somebody who worked on the program. To think that this is a hoax is to be delusional. I'll be very blunt about it. And it's disgraceful to me, because it's one of the great achievements of our nation. And to want to discredit our country in that way says more about the people who say it than it does about the nation.
As far as the Black Knight, it's a satellite purportedly 13,000 years old circling the planet from some other star system. Who knows where? I don't know if that's true or not. We are going to do a show on that in the future. It's an incredible story. Have you ever heard about that?
Not at all.
Okay.
And I will tell you, George, sorry, I'm a skeptic.
I know you are.
Yeah.
But you do believe in life out there somewhere, don't you?
Well, I mean, I think it would be very unlikely in the size of the universe for there not to be life elsewhere. But I also know that until we find it, science is based on knowledge, not on speculation. So we got to find it first. I wouldn't be surprised if I'd be more surprised if we don't find it. Let's put it that way. I would not be surprised if we find life on another world. But that doesn't mean it's there. That just means that's how I see the odds.
One of our coast-to-coast regular callers, Bill from West Hartford, Connecticut, is with us. Hey, Bill. Good morning.
Hi, George. Hi. Hi, Robert Zimmerman. Hi. I'm an amateur astronomer and a space enthusiast, and I have two great questions for you. Let me first quickly say to the caller just before me, yes, I've seen many, not only still photos, two dozen or more still photos from the lunar surface of the Earth from different Apollo missions, and the Earth has different phases, like Apollo 11 in one part of the moon, the eastern side, the Earth is more closer to being round versus say Apollo 12, which is in the western side of the moon. The Earth is a little more towards a crescent, as well as DVDs. I have DVD sets from spacecraftfilms.com of Apollo's 15, 16, and 17. A video from the lunar rover that had better TV camera where it zoomed in on the moon in all three missions. And I remember it from 40 years ago when I saw it then. I'm George Norrie's age. Here's my two quick questions. Great questions. I'll ask them together and then listen to you answer. Question number one, there's a great, great, great unmanned mission. When I say the name, you know exactly that I'm thrilled about this year, finally, 2014, Rosetta, that was launched a decade ago. European Space Agency mission to orbit a comet, I can't pronounce its name, and it has a lander, Philae, that will land on the comet in November, hopefully successfully. We'll get video from the surface of the comet and other data when Rosetta orbits it in August. My second question is, first question, would you discuss what I just said? Second question, would you discuss the results from the BICEP 2 instrument in Antarctica that recently proved inflation, and since inflation has been proved to be true, at least by BICEP 2, it does imply, if not prove, that the multiverse has to be correct. The many universes theory has to be correct if inflation is correct. Correct.
Bill, thank you. You've called before when I've been on the air and always ask good questions. Yes. I have to say.
He loves you, Bobby. He loves you.
Yeah, well, he had good questions. He knows his stuff.
He does.
And if it reminded me, you know, lunar missions, for example, I'm always focused on looking at what the moon looks like because that's where we went to study. But Bill's absolutely correct. He jogged my memory about the numerous videos that they took from the moon of the Earth. They zoomed in on it from the from the surface. So that's an absurd statement by the previous caller. First of all, let me do BICEP 2 first. Did this prove inflation? I am a skeptic when it comes to the Big Bang theory. It fits all the data. So people who are physicists should not misconstrue what I'm saying. Based on the data we have now, the Big Bang theory and inflation fits the data. It's the best explanation for the origins of the universe. But I personally think, even BICEP 2's data that seem to confirm the theory of inflation, or at least some parts of it, the data involved here is minuscule considering what will be needed to really understand what happened 13, 14 billion years ago. And so I remain a skeptic. I don't think anything's proven. I think theories have been underlined, given greater strength. We have a better idea of where to go to search for the truth. But has anything been proven? I'm not so sure. As for Rosetta, this is absolutely one of the most spectacular potential missions
ever, other than the moon landings.
Well, it's just great what's going to happen this year. We're going to have an unmanned probe orbit a comet very close, and I can't pronounce the name either, so Bill shouldn't be ashamed of that. It's one of these long, I think it's a Polish and a Russian discovered it, and there isn't a vowel in either name. but nonetheless, it's going to orbit this comet very close up, and it's going to release a probe that's going to soft land on the comet nucleus. And so we're going to get a really close look at a comet and get a better idea of what these things are. And I think this is just This is just great. And there's not much else I can say to it, except I can't wait. I mean, Rosetta, they launched it a decade ago. It's passed a few. It's actually done some flybys of asteroids, but the last flyby was about 3 years ago. They put it into hibernation, and they just woke it up a few months ago. And, you know, of course, if it doesn't wake up, the whole mission's dead. But after 10 years in orbit, 3 years of in hibernation, it came back to life. So did Philae, the lander. It's a functional craft. Everything looks good. It's gotten its first images of the comet from a far distance away. So everything looks go, and it's going to be really cool when this happens.
Here's the name of the comet. You ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Churyumov Gerasimenko.
You're good, George. I've read it, and I have it posted on my website, but I have never been able to successfully pronounce that.
Who's going to be able to question me anyway?
Yeah, true.
It is what it is. Let's take one more caller here. Let's go to Trey in Shreveport, Louisiana. Hey, Trey, go ahead.
Hey, I was just listening to the show a few moments ago, and I heard the gentleman speaking about we can't prove that there is life in other galaxies, or he would be more surprised if we don't prove life in other realms of the galaxy. Well, how would you explain all of the UFO sightings, Roswell for one, if there isn't life?
Well, what does UFO stand for? It stands for unidentified flying object. It's an unknown what that is. So from my perspective, we don't know what it is. It could very well be explained by, and usually are explained by, very pedestrian, run-of-the-mill type things. But because it's an unknown, some of them aren't explained. So yes, they might be. Yes, they might be aliens who are flying around looking us over, but don't want to talk to us. But I'm skeptical of that. That doesn't mean it's not true. I'm skeptical of it, and the reason I'm skeptical of UFOs being alien ships is because if we were visiting another planet of a technological society like ours, even if we're superior at that time, we're going to want to make contact because there is benefits from both sides, and there's questions that can be answered, and curiosity is going to almost guarantee the contact. So you're not going to keep secrets in those situations. So that's why I'm skeptical that there's aliens who visit us. That me being skeptical isn't proof of anything. It's my opinion. But that's where I stand. Now, having to do with their life elsewhere, once again, the odds are very totally in favor of there being life elsewhere. The number of planets, the amount of time the universe has existed, the number of stars, the fact that we're now finding there are exoplanets around every single star, without any question there's going to be exoplanets out there, well, that truly increased the odds of alien life. But until, from a scientific perspective, the way you do this that built our technological society, you got to wait. You got to look for the data. Until we actually make a discovery, you can't make an assumption. If you make the assumption, you'll never look for the data, and you won't really find what's out there.
And again, Robert's website, behindtheblack.com, and his latest work, Genesis, the Story of Apollo 8, is now available as an ebook as well. Is it not, Robert?
Yes, it is. And if people want to know, read about a time when the United States was willing to do things in a risky manner to be the best in the world, they should read that book. They went to the moon. They went to the moon to orbit the moon thinking that chances were good. The chances were 50-50 of success, and they went anyway.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate you being on the show. Good spirit on the Bob Dylan spoof as well. We'll be back in a moment. A roundtable discussion with a topic that should be dear to all of you. We'll be back.